Shrink Wrap Radio number 783. Elise Brenner, PhD, and Nancy Spatz, MD, Reiki Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are Elise Brenner, PhD, and Nancy Spatz, MD, authors of the book Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others, which will be the focus of our discussion. Now, here's the interview. Doctors Elise Brenner and Nancy Spatz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having us, David. This is so exciting and quite an honor. We're grateful.
Oh, well, thank you. I feel honored as well. In our email exchanges, you two are so very gracious. And we're going to be discussing your book, Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace and with Self and Others. And so I'm really looking forward to that because I've heard about Reiki for years, but I've never really experienced it, which is pretty amazing living in California because there's a whole lot of everything here, as you may know. And the word Reiki, it sounds Japanese. Is it? And if so, do we know what the word means, if anything?
Yeah, I take this one. Thank you. Reiki, it's a kanji, a character, a Japanese writing character came from China into Japan. And when you see the kanji of Reiki written, they are quite revealing, but in a nutshell, it means sacred energy or spiritual energy or even soul, S-O-U-L energy, but not maybe a Western conceptualization of a soul as an individually bound entity, but rather much enlarging than that, much more spacious than that. So maybe spiritual or sacred would be better understood by the audience in the West. So yeah. Sacred energy.
Okay, that makes sense to me. And it kind of sounds like an ancient martial art. What can you tell us about the origins? And maybe, Nancy, we should throw that one to you.
Well, we have divvied up. The history.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's really funny. Yeah, we're prepared for throwing the ball to each other.
Okay,
but this is the one I embrace.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting that you will see on Google Reiki, an ancient Japanese system, but really the person who developed the system, the teachings, the practices of Reiki lived in the late 1800s to early 1900s. Okay. But this man, Sensei Usui, was a very learned Buddhist lay priest.
Okay.
Therefore, the antecedents, everything that came before the system of Reiki, informed his teachings. And that would be Shintoism, Buddhism, Taoism, And around this time that he was living, many, many martial arts systems, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. arose, and you find these beautiful, almost like it's like a weaving together of teachings and practices between, for example, Aikido.
Yes.
And Reiki Japanese meditations and teachings, except yeah. we don't have a sword.
Yeah. You mentioned Aikido. I've had a longstanding interest as a younger person, not as much now, in the martial arts, Japanese martial arts. Studied judo for a number of years, and would have liked to have studied Aikido. That really appealed to me at an aesthetic level. And as you say, some of these systems, like Aikido, actually, while they were based on ancient traditions, were actually had relatively modern founders. So Aikido, I think, probably came to be in about the same time frame as the Reiki. And of course, that makes me wonder if Reiki is about directing chi, since you mentioned energy, and I know that plays a big role in the martial arts.
Yeah, so one of the things about Reiki and karate is there are similar principles, and one of the foundations is grounding, feeling yourself balanced, mind-body balance. And the primary step before you do anything else in Reiki really is making sure that you are grounded. And I'm sure you're familiar with that with karate.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was judo, not karate. But so they do talk about chi quite a bit. And also in acupuncture, you know, they talk about the energy in the body that flows along different channels, not the nerve system that we're aware of, but other channels that they've identified. So I wondered if it's anything similar to that, similar to, let's say, acupuncture.
Well, I think that's a great question. And keep in mind that this was very much during the time of Usui in Japan, kind of like a household folk medicine art for some people, right? And so the idea of, shall we say, directing, managing, controlling on the one hand, and knowing traditional Chinese medicine, meridians, nadis, it's really not required. So the question then becomes one of how outcome oriented is traditional Japanese Reiki practice versus a more directed channeling idea, which you might find in some modern Western schools of Reiki in the West. But from our Japanese training, there's a lot of the practitioner and even the self, if it's a self practice, stepping back in a more humble way from being the director and just more being allowing and being a facilitator of the recipient, who may be yourself, being the facilitator of their own healing process versus a manager and a director.
Elise, you mentioned our Japanese training, and so I'm really wondering about your training, whether you two train together or separately, whether in fact you've been to Japan for the training or not, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I know that neither of us have had that capacity to go to Japan. Actually, to be quite clear, our Japanese training is actually with a Western Reiki practitioner, and he is the one that goes to Japan.
Okay. Yeah.
And then he is just so generous with the teachings that he experiences there. And so Wonderful. He has done the work there. Yeah.
And how did the two of you meet?
So we met at a Reiki conference a while back, and we started talking, and we realized that we had a lot in common with our thoughts about, you know, getting the word out about Reiki to help as many people as possible. And from that point, we then, you know, decided to write the book together and explain Reiki in a manageable way that people can use.
Yeah. So maybe you can tell us something about the structure of the book.
Sure. So the structure of the book is that we start off with explaining what Reiki is and then a little bit of the history. And then we go through different practices in the system of Reiki. We have specific chapters on how to breathe, how we're breathing. We also have some other meditations. And then we have another chapter on the pause, which is part of pause of non-reactivity, and that's really helpful. And the other thing that's really nice about that, well, we love about our book is that we have real life anecdotes, so people can put the practices into their life. And one of my favorite chapters is we have a chapter on sort of where to start and what to do, because there's so many different forms of Reiki. And as Elise has mentioned, we, you know, stick with the basic Japanese teachings, and you can read so much and do so much, and after you're like, okay, so now what should I do? So we give specific direct examples and sort of how to's, and so people can take the practice and learn what to do and then use it.
Yeah. And also I should mention there are pictures in the book, drawings, line drawings to give people a sense of where to place their hands when they're doing self Reiki. And so that of course is an important element, because a person might really wonder about, you know, how they're going to do that. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering, you know, I had the impression that Reiki would involve the client or patient lying down on a table and a practitioner either hands-on or hands hovering above, I'm not sure which. And here we've got self-Reiki, which was definitely the new idea for me here. And I'm wondering, is that a recent development, or is that something you two invented, or what?
We'd be very famous. So this begins first and foremost in Japan as a self-practice, meditation practices.
Okay.
Kenyoku ho, Joshin Kokyu ho, as well as a system of precepts, five precepts, which is one of our chapters for contemplation. And in the West, think of cultural context here. It's just the conditionings, the cultural conditionings where people want to be accomplishing and productive and kind of the healer in the spotlight, to be kind of crass about it. And so it became much more of a doing and practitioner directed than a being and a self-directed. But because of the understanding of non-duality, that the self is like a field, not a bounded entity, very Dr. Richard Schwartz, internal family systems oriented. It is much more than that. So what we cultivate from within, with the precepts and the meditations, we bring out into the world simply by being. So the self practice is very transformative, both self and others, both, you might say, jiriki and tariki, two really helpful Japanese terms. Now, this does not mean that we don't, like I spent 2 years volunteering in a hospice and a year volunteering Reiki practice in a hospital or with veterans and bringing it out into the world. But just think how that's one person at a time lying on a table. But if I can go into the Center for Violence Prevention and Recovery at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and do outreach training based on the practices in our book.
Oh, thank you for showing the book.
Kind of happy to do that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so and give us the thickness view so we can see how many pages are. Yeah, okay, so a reasonable length, okay. Mm-hmm. It's under 200 pages, I believe. Right?
It is exactly, including a very long references cited because of academia that we're in. It's about, including all that, it's 142.
Yeah. So you get a lot packed into a small package. Now, you mentioned family systems therapy, internal family systems.
I did.
And that rings a bell of, oh, you must be a therapist. Do you have a background in doing psychotherapy?
No. I don't.
Okay.
I'm not the one. I'm the public health person and the anthropologist.
Okay.
Reiki practice brings you into multiple places, but now I turn it over to Dr. Spatz.
So, yes, I trained in psychiatry at the Beth Israel Hospital, and I saw a lot of, tough situations, and always I trained in psychology, actually, in college, and then I went on to medical school, and then I did my
psychiatry. I'm sorry, I missed the word. You trained in what in college?
I trained in psychology. Psychology. Yes.
Yeah.
And then I went on to medical school.
Okay.
And from there, I did my residency in psychiatry at the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. And I just, throughout the whole training, I was always thinking about preventative medicine.
Uh-huh.
And what could people do to try to help themselves, not, even before, during, or after a medical problem? So I was very into psychology, and I found, always researched different options that people could have as an adjunct to medicine. And that's when I got involved with learning about Reiki, because a lot of our teachings in the book are based on the biological aspects of bringing on the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yes, yes.
Which I'm sure you're very familiar, obviously, but where you relax and decrease inflammation, decrease cortisol, and set your body up for a more healing situation. But I was just going to add one other thing to the last topic that we had about self-Reiki. And the thing that, and this connects with what I'm saying, is that a lot of the time when people are ill or are having a tough circumstance, it's very hard to go out, find a therapist, do something where, just even going to get groceries sometimes is hard.
Sure.
So when Elise and I started talking about Reiki and how important it is to be able to do something that you can do yourself so that when you are in the midst of the ups and downs of life, you can rely on yourself. And of course, it's nice to be in groups and do the practices together and have, you know, do hands-on healing teaching. But the focus of our self-Reiki book was so that people can have something that they can have and bring out for themselves, sort of by breath and making your mind body clear, you can then feel stronger. And Reiki, you know, is not curative. We think of it as a healing practice, because even though you may be going through a medical illness or you may be having a hard time, that you can still feel whole, because it's the whole, your whole essence, or as Elise said earlier, your sort of soul self. And so our goal in writing this book was to help as many people as we possibly could with both big and, you know, small challenges, to feel better about themselves so they can then go out and help others too.
Yeah, you mentioned something about groups, and so tell us about groups. Is there I'm imagining in these days of COVID, maybe there are Zoom groups. Do you guys lead Zoom groups with people who are doing self-Reiki?
Yes, there's actually nodding. Quite a lot going on in the world, and so I want to honor all our colleagues who are also doing much work in regard to this. And I'd like to go back just a couple of years pre-COVID in terms of groups. Like, let's say there's a support group for survivors of intimate partner violence that meets in a given town. So if I'm invited there, I could, you know, meet with each person individually in a room with a Reiki table, and I did that as well. But then I can be with them all together in this very kind of egalitarian, accessible, user-friendly practice that they can then take home. They can teach to their children, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the in-person work that I did, in, I call it outreach, and, you know, an elder service to veterans, wherever it was, okay?
Yeah.
That was one thing. Getting that situation into Zoom hasn't been as easy as I would like, and we're kind of hoping that the book will help that along. So I have Wednesday evening. I'm also a mindfulness trained person.
Okay.
So it's Reiki meditation and mindfulness gatherings. It's just half an hour, and I open it to anybody. You don't have to be trained. And so are other people worldwide doing such a thing.
Yeah.
And yes, we may all be putting our hands on ourselves, but maybe we're in Gassho doing a Gassho meditation, or putting our hands in our laps, or we're doing Kinyoku Ho. There's so many, there's a series of Japanese Reiki practices and meditations. So it's, and then there's the precept. So there's much more than hands-on off healing of self and others involved. But all of this can be shared generously.
You mentioned before five precepts as kind of being very important bedrock of this practice. So maybe you can tell us what those are.
Nancy, do you want to start? Yeah.
So the first, there are five precepts, and it really is the foundation of Reiki. And the first one is do not live in worry. And people have different ways of presenting it, but we usually say do not live in worry, or do not fuel worry, do not live in I'm sorry. Do not. I was thinking the first one is do not live in anger. Worry is always the one that always comes up for everyone because everyone is always worried. So
okay.
I'm sorry.
Do not live in anger.
Yeah. Do not live in anger. Do not live in worry. Be grateful. Be true to your way in being, or be honest with yourself. And do the things with on purpose, with purpose. And the fifth one is being compassionate to yourself and then others. And Elise has a very nice way of how she frames the first two and the last three. So Elise, would you like to proceed with that?
Yeah.
Is that okay, Dave?
Yeah,
David?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Japanese phraseology of the precepts, it doesn't translate so well into English. So I took liberties to play around to make it more, you know, user-friendly or operational to people. And so, yeah, if we say, just for today, I do not fuel, F-U-E-L, anger, uh-huh. It means that I must first be aware that anger is arising within me, mm-hmm. that I've been triggered, and that I may be reactive. And then saying I don't fuel anger then says once I recognize the signals, often in the body, and you're ready to go, right?
Yeah.
I bring in the openness of choice. Oh, I can touch that anger. I'm not going to shoo it away. Phew, right? I'm not going to deny it. Right? I'm not going to bring the poisons in. I am going to acknowledge, accept. Yeah. But then my choice is, I've touched it. Do I really have to fuel it with my words and my actions? So then the second, just for today, do not fuel worry. So we can feel that just coming up. And people are very smart. I can go into places with 20 people and I say, where in your body might you feel worry? And they all can point. They're all incredibly in touch. It always impresses me.
Yeah.
And so you start to learn your signs and signals from the body. And then again, don't shoo it away. Be mindful. Acknowledge. There it is again. There's that worry.
Right.
There's the thinking. There's the emotion. But do I really have to fuel that right now? Maybe I don't. And our teacher, his name is Franz. He's European. Franz Stina. He often says almost like there's three in the two. No anger, no worry, no fear. With the understanding that we're all with fear, simply trying to, I mean, my understanding of this becomes that we're protecting ourselves because we love ourselves and we want to protect ourselves, but really it backfires on us.
Yeah. Well, I think that fear often, underlies both anger and worry, right?
Exactly.
So if we go down, that's
exactly. And these two at the beginning, or three, anger, worry, fear, they're really all about that which separates us from others. They're all about distance. Even if we say, I worry about my children because I love and I want to be close to them, but no, let's get real. No. So they're about separation. And then the last three, just for today, I practice thankfulness or gratitude. For today, I'm true to my way and my being, which means if I'm true to my way and my being, I have to be true, David, to your way and your being, and I have to honor that. And then the third one, I show compassionate action to all beings, including myself. Those are all about connection. Those are all about non-separation. So in a sense, once the first 2/3, anger, worry, and fear, are honestly worked with, diligently practiced with. The others are just part of us. And boom, yeah. Out they come, because they've just been covered up by these layers of conditionings. And it can take, well, I will be honest, you know, 20 years and I'm still uncovering, you know.
Sure.
That's why when people can learn these practices early in their life, you know, young people, I think they're going to prevent much suffering. Yeah. Not all suffering,
yeah.
But they can prevent some.
Well, what you're saying about these precepts certainly makes a psychological sense, spiritual sense, psychotherapeutic sense. I mean, we get pretty much the same message from a variety of sources, academic, traditional, etc. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Now, I know in the book you use some analogies or metaphors, one of which is a palm tree. Tell us about that. How does a palm tree express the idea of Reiki?
Sure. So in our book, we talk about how we're breathing. I don't know if you're familiar with that, David, but it's a way, it's the breath that you take a refreshing breath in through your mouth, nose, and bring it all the way down to a space called the heart space, which is about, it's midline in the body, a few finger breaths below the navel. And I talked about the parasympathetic nervous system before, and relaxing the body and setting up ideal situation for healing. So when you take this deep power breath in and then you let it out without force, a longer out breath, you steady the body by calming the nervous system. And this gets back to our analogy with the palm tree, because if you look at a palm tree in the middle of a storm, and the top of the palm tree, all the fronds are blowing about and it's very chaotic and busy, and then you look down to the base of a palm tree, it's steady and grounded. And so our analogy is that we can be like a palm tree in a storm, because with this hard breathing and parasympathetic nervous system helping our body calm and steady, we look towards that to help us.
Yeah, yeah, and I am familiar with that breathing, again, from many traditions, one of which is Hatha Yoga, which I practiced for many years. And now we find it showing up in other systems as well.
That reminds me. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I thought you were pausing.
I may have paused. Go ahead.
You know, all these systems that are converging, you know, yeah, Aikido, right, or, you know, everything we've been talking,
yeah,
about.
Right.
They are all systems or teachings or practices of wisdom and compassion. And so they're going to have similar elements that the human consciousness has discovered through experience actually works.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard the expression, they're just different paths up the mountain.
Right, right.
And, you know, finding your path and sticking to it and not like, oh, let me go here, let me go there, I think can be, you know, sometimes a helpful way for people.
Yeah.
You know, in a commercial society like ours, where, you know, you're definitely being pulled to, oh, this, I'm never good enough with just my own practice. I think it can be a rough road for many people.
Definitely. Definitely. because there's a lot of wind blowing in our palm trees.
Definitely.
And I think for us Westerners, one of the things that's made it even more acceptable are the ways in which science kind of finds a basis for many of these things. So, for example, Nancy, you mentioned the parasympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And so, oh, yes, the Western mind, my Western mind understands that. We have some science behind it. And it also makes sense on all these other levels. Another metaphor that you use or analogy is snow globe. And how is that different than the palm tree? What are we getting at with that metaphor?
It's really not that dissimilar, right?
Right.
So when I go to outreach or if I'm doing something on Zoom, I show it. It's Boston. Hey, we're from the area here.
Okay.
When we shake up the snow globe, the snow particles make it so I can't really see the scene of Boston very clearly, right? Yeah, so, but when the snow particles settle down and down and down, we can see more clearly.
Yeah.
And so obviously the analogy is untangling the knots. I mean, K-N-O-T-S, untangling the knots of the mind. And in a practice called Joshin Kokuho, settling the mind into the body through the breath, as Nancy explained, we bring the breath down into the lower belly. We unify the mind with that so that we can begin to kind of tame the mind or befriend the mind. And so that's the analogy of the snow settling down into the hara, and the hara, the lower belly, is our connection to earth ki, earth energy, all that is solid and steady and like that.
Yeah.
Sustaining.
And there's one more metaphor that you cover in the book that is almost self-explanatory, which is the compass. I assume it's self-explanatory.
Yes, we talk about the precepts as being a compass, sort of that you're able to direct your way by following the precepts. So it is self-explanatory. But it, as Elise had mentioned, it's really important to contemplate all of these precepts that we're talking about. And it takes, you know, several years to really get a feel so you know, can let go of anger, can let go of worry, be grateful. And again, as you lift the worry and the anger, then the gratitude and honesty that you feel for yourself with your purpose and your compassion for yourself and to others becomes clearer with like a compass with a direction. So in our book, we actually have ways of looking at each precept and how to contemplate it so you can eventually feel better. That may sound simplistic, but really the purpose of the book is to help people feel better for whatever, you know, big or small challenges that they're going through. And we talk about in the book that, you know, life is not a straight line. You go forward, you go backwards, you can even go sideways. But by having these precepts as a direction or a compass can help you. And that's our goal.
Yeah, and I'd like to add on, Nancy, that, yeah, it's really important that all the listeners really know that we embrace everybody when we go off course, our compass, where we've lost our way. And when we lose our way and maybe we all fall apart a little bit, with Reiki practice, sometimes we can
gather all those pieces back together and feel more intact, maybe a little bit sooner, or maybe in that process, we come to a new level of understanding of maybe what we really need that has not been met. Maybe I just need to ask for help more often. That would be a big discovery. Maybe I need to trust more in other people to support me. But I've been like plowing through, going it alone. So it's really, that's why the practice can only really happen in daily life. It's our daily life.
Right.
That's our practice. And our daily life, that's going to tell us without any dishonesty when we're going off course, because we are going to go off course.
Yeah, so it's easy to have grand ideas and grand self-conceptions of oneself, but daily life, where the rubber meets the road, as they say, will quickly orient you towards, okay, this is who I really am, and this is what I'm really dealing with. You alluded earlier to the fact that there are examples in the book of benefits, I guess I would say, that people have experienced. Maybe you can share a few of those, two or three of those, to kind of give us a sense of the range of issues that can be addressed via self-Reiki.
I have a question of clarification, David, just in the intent of your question.
Yeah.
And sorry for being slow on this one. Maybe you're referring to the anecdotes and how they actually benefited people.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd like to start with one that's really true blue, and that is a waiting room in a hospital or in a doctor's office. And let's not bring COVID into this for now. Just you're waiting for the result of a test. Maybe you're waiting at home, but there's something about that doctor's office where you can't distract yourself with doing the laundry or baking cookies, right?
Yeah.
Or going back to work, where we're complex beings and we can hold a lot. You are sitting there for what may be over an hour. And you can be, you know, just pretty much, you could be sitting perfectly still. And from, it looks like everyone is just handling it so well. They're all just sitting here leafing through stupid magazines. But their heads may be completely spiraling out.
Yeah.
And of course they would be. Who would blame them in a situation like that? And because you're in public, it's so easy just to bring your hands to your own body. No one's going to think a thing of putting your hands on your torso or on your belly. It's just like you're resting them here. And doing the, as Nancy explained, HARA, H-A-R-A, breathing practice with the gently lengthened exhale.
Right.
Now, what's interesting there is because we are so complex, thoughts will still run through your mind of this impending results, but you will be experiencing your worry from a slightly more intact base. So it's sometimes not changing everything, but how we're going to be with the waiting. And if we can be a little bit present and not jump to the results that may be actually good news, yes, they may not be good news, we may just hang in there a little bit better, because once we start that churning and churning of the sympathetic nervous system, over time, that weathers. All like erosion, it weathers away all the systems of the body. It's not just what's happening,
right.
You know, it's like if the mind says it's happening, the body says, yes, it's happening. I got bad news and I, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great example, waiting in a medical waiting room, something we can all identify with. Is there another one that comes to mind?
Yeah, I have a favorite one.
Yeah, so good.
I like them all. So, but I also just wanted to add to the waiting in the waiting room, that if even for that moment we can feel less anxious, it can help us get through the process of waiting for the result. And the more we're less anxious in the moment, then those times can sort of come together. And we all know that there are extreme moments of anxiety that you just don't know what to do. And as Elise said, things just get more and more chaotic. So the hope of, you know, our practice is to help people feel less stressed even for that moment. So I just wanted to add that. And then one of the anecdotes, one of our chapters in our book, chapter 4, is called the intentional response or the mindful pause. And this is just so important in how we react to situations. And again, Reiki self-practice can help you be able to pause and sort of help the overall situation instead of jumping in and fixing. And that's one of the antidotes. We have the situation where and it can be applied to any situation, but where, you know, someone lost their job and their friend wanted to come over and bring them all these different job opportunities. Well, you can do this and you can do that. And, you know, and I have this whole list of, you know, employment opportunities. And the person that lost their job really just wanted someone to listen to them about how they lost their job. But so if we're able to pause by the different teachings that we have in the book, we're more able to listen to what people really want or need at the moment. So it's just a very helpful way to be able to listen to people.
Well, I think that pause that you're talking about is kind of at the crux of mindfulness, in a sense, because we always have some place that we immediately want to go to, but every moment offers a possibility of a decision of what, you know, what's the wisest, best, highest thing that I could do in this moment. And the trick is in the flurry of life is to have the awareness of that pause, to remember to pause and take that moment rather than just being reactive, totally reactive. And as you pointed out, it can really take years of practice, of concerted practice, to have the discipline, the mental discipline, to be aware of that possibility.
Yeah, and that's brings up something that Nancy said, which is that, I guess one way to put it, and that has to do with what you just said, David, is every moment that we practice, it's kind of like cumulative over time.
Yeah.
Like, yes, there's a Japanese phrase, Shinshin Kaizen, which is right in the precepts, and it means mind-body harmony. And so, it's cumulative. It's not going to happen right away. And each time we pause and it brings us freedom in the moment and a more beautiful interaction with somebody, more beautiful speech, not speaking to somebody, that becomes its own reward. And yeah, pat yourself on the back. Go ahead, people, pat yourself on the back.
that's huge, huge, like almost like a human consciousness victory.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, and that's why, you know, mindfulness has become way into the mainstream, as you said, with evidence-based stuff. And Reiki is a little bit behind. Reiki practice is just a wee little bit behind that. And one of the points of our book is to actually mainstreaming. And there are many wonderful Reiki practitioners that really want to get Reiki practice into the mainstream. And there are some, you know, randomized controlled trials, which is very hard to do with Reiki to get this mainstream, you know. I'm not sure they're the best models. Randomized controlled trials are the best model for how to really study this, because what's a dose of Reiki practice?
Yeah, right.
I mean, really,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it'd be very
so
hard
it
to...
becomes quite difficult, but nonetheless, there are some with some measurable outcomes, and the number of people, subjects, so to speak, is rather small. So certainly it can do no harm, and it may do quite a lot of benefit is what they all end up saying.
Yes. It was also interesting. I was once doing a Reiki treatment in a hospital, and just as I was doing the treatment, and, you know, this is just me and one other person doing the treatment, but it was just so interesting because all of a sudden the person's blood pressure went down, their heart rate went down, and they actually fell asleep. But so it just, you know, it's how you feel yourself, and just uncovering your energy or your light. And I think when you start to do the different practices, you'll slowly but surely feel it. And I just don't want anyone to feel overwhelmed when we say it takes years to, you know, contemplate the precepts, because it takes a long time, but it also works in the moment.
Okay.
And actually in our book, we talk about doing practices or tools for in the moment. And we also talk about how you can have a sustainable Reiki practice for longer term. But, you know, it really can help in the moment. And so, you know, and really this period in the world is just, I think, you know, beyond stressful. So anything.
Right.
Anything.
We have unlimited opportunities to use
all day, every day.
Yeah. And I appreciate the point that you're making, that there can be immediate benefits, not just long-term benefits. And so I think that's a really key point. As we sort of wrap it up here, I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to get in that we haven't really spoken to, or that you haven't had a chance to get in. Yeah, Lee?
I have one point, which is, I believe it's chapter 10. It is about Reiki practice and social justice. And I think this is very important. Reiki practice over time and in the moment is really about embracing a kind of participatory consciousness with really all people, all beings, all trees, et cetera, right? I know that can sound pretty fluffy, but it is actually the most down-to-earth point that can be made about Reiki practice. If we can have that non-separation between me and you, there is no me, there is no you, there is no me, there is no othering. This is what it will take to transform communities, societies, shift norms,
etc. And so if you are a responsible, self-responsible person, you are not unaware of social injustice. And for me, Reiki practitioners take on and are taking on a repairing of the world endeavors on all many, many levels, because you can't have one without the other when you have participation consciousness. It's not you getting killed by the police. I mean, I live in white skin, but, and I don't have the same experience. I can't pretend to have the same experience, but I'm connected to you. I feel a connection to you. So the least I can do is be an ally or an accomplice in the work.
Okay.
So I want to just shed a little bit light on
that. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you spoke to that, because it's kind of implied in the title of the book, Live in Peace with Self and Others. And so that helps to explain what you're getting at there. Dr. Elise Brinner and Dr. Nancy Spatz, thanks for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio. My guests today, Elise Brinner, PhD, and Nancy Spatz, MD, authors of the book Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others, have written a very practical self-help book. Living in California, I certainly have heard of Reiki over the years, but never seriously looked into it. I had some sense that it might involve a Reiki practitioner working with a prone client on a massage table. I assumed the client would be in a relatively passive role, with the practitioner manipulating their body to get the chi channels unblocked, thereby facilitating healing. I'd never heard of self-Reiki and thought it might be a very recent innovation, perhaps invented by my guests. Not so. They informed me that Reiki was developed in Japan by one Mikao Usui. The approach drew upon the philosophical and spiritual insights of Buddhism and Shintoism. According to my guests, Reiki arose during a fertile period in which some of the martial arts we've all heard of, such as Aikido and Judo, came into being. It was a period of a sort of renaissance, with new arts springing from the shared historical, philosophical, spiritual, and cultural soil of Japan. Nor is the practice of self-Reiki a new innovation. Rather, they say, it's a worldwide phenomenon that's been around for some time. Reiki healing is not a dramatic cure for physical disease and injury. Rather, it's a form of meditation that can ease psychological suffering in the moment and perhaps over time create the underlying balance in the body, mind, soul that can make recovery from disease and trauma more likely. Doctors Brinner and Spatz emphasize the five precepts on which the practice is based. According to one recent formulation, the five Reiki precepts or principles can be expressed in the following terms. I release angry thoughts and feelings. I release thoughts of worry. I'm grateful for my many blessings. I practice expanding my consciousness. I'm gentle with all beings, including myself. The authors use several metaphors in their book to suggest the way Reiki can help. I particularly like the image of the palm tree. I picture it on a Pacific island with hurricane-force winds violently tossing the fronds one way and another. And the force of the wind may even temporarily bend the tall trunk of the tree, yet the roots cling firmly to the soil. It's a healing metaphor in itself, during this time of fears stimulated by raging pandemics, the ravages of climate change, and the rantings of political demagogues. I'm impressed by the commitment of Drs. Brenner and Spatz to community service in hospitals, clinics, school settings, and their online trainings, as well as this practical and helpful book. Once again, the title is Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others, by Elise Brenner, Ph.D., and Nancy Spatz, M.D.
This is Ted Leckie. I'm an EFT couples therapist practicing in Toronto. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for years and love the breadth of modalities and therapeutic ideas I have been exposed to by listening. I can't count the number of books I have ended up buying after listening to your interviews, following up on wonderful new directions. Thanks so much, Dr. Dave. Your podcast is much appreciated.
Thank you, Ted, there in Toronto. I appreciate your donations and your encouragement for others to join our honor roll of donors. Thank you also to first-time donor Madeline Cook. You are now on our honor roll. You may have noticed a change in my voice since the last episode. I'm happy to report that my attack of Omicron was blessedly short. For about 4 days, it was like a really bad cold. Now I'm in my sixth day of being symptom-free. Time to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to today's guests, Elise Brenner, Ph.D., and Nancy Spatz, M.D., for discussing their very practical book, Reiki, A Self-Practice to Live in Peace with Self and Others. Next week, I'll be speaking with Mary Frances O'Connor, Ph.D., about her book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.